Mayday, your flight podcast about everything you don't want to happen on your plane. Today is our third and final episode. Oh, also, I'm Caroline Miller. You already knew that, probably. Today is our third and final episode on the infamously unidentifiable D.B. Cooper, the man whose dynamite-fueled hijacking captivated the world and stumped the FBI. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes, go listen to those right now. This will be here when you're done. Today, we are finishing up our series by covering the rest of the FBI's 45-year investigation into the hijacking, and most importantly, we are covering theories about who D.B. Cooper is, why he did this, and where he went afterward. Trevor is joining us again today. Welcome back, Trevor!
I'm back. This is the final part of D.B. Cooper, and this is my final appearance on the Mayday podcast.
That's not true, unless you want it to be. Do you hate me?
No, I mean, I'm in high demand. I don't know, I can't.
You're so full of it. Okay. So, anyone who has watched or read anything about police work knows that forensic sketches and criminal profiling are some of the most intriguing aspects of criminology. The sketch of D.B. Cooper is no different, because not only did people have differing ideas of what he looked like, but they were all so different that it was almost comical. However, this didn't stop people from being extremely opinionated on what he really looked like. There were three composite sketches that were released by the FBI. The first one, Composite Sketch A, was released just a few days after the hijacking, and everyone hated it. Florence Schaffner, the flight attendant who first interacted with Cooper, was especially vocal on how much she hated it and how inaccurate it was to her. This first sketch is a black and white sketch of a young-looking man with a narrow face, very pale skin, and the world's biggest forehead. Everybody said that he looked too young and too pale, and notably, people also said that the sketch was missing the bored, let's get this over with facial expression that Cooper apparently had the entire hijacking. I guess the enthusiasm was a bit too much on that first FBI composite sketch. He was too full of joy. The second sketch was released almost a year later, and it was titled, In a Burst of Creativity, Composite Sketch B. This sketch took into account people's complaints about the first sketch, Composite Sketch A, and people did agree that Composite Sketch B was certainly an improvement. In this sketch, Cooper had a rounder face with an olive skin tone, a nice, bored facial expression, and more wrinkles. However, they still weren't totally happy because witnesses said that the second sketch depicted a man that was too, quote, angry and nasty. And one person even said that the new sketch made Cooper look like a, quote, hoodlum, and that Cooper was, quote, more refined in appearance. So people seem like they kind of like Cooper. They're like, no, he's nice and he's put together, but he also looks really bored. And, you know, if that clip-on tie is any indication, we all know that Cooper was a refined and classy man and certainly no hoodlum. Trevor's looking at the composite sketches right now. Yeah, that's A. If you're looking up the pictures right now, the composite sketch that's in black and white only, that's A. The second one, where they're using color for the first time, is B. And then the next one is the one that we're going to dive into right now, where he has more of like a warm undertone to his skin and he looks a bit nicer. So that is Composite Sketch C. And the FBI put this one out in April of 1973. And with this third sketch, they were just like, you know what? This is it, losers. Take it or leave it. I'm not making another composite sketch for you picky people. And luckily for the FBI, everybody was like, oh, this one looks good. And one flight attendant even said that Cooper could be easily recognized from the new sketch.
We ought to find him soon, then.
Oh, yeah, we're going to find this man real soon. So if Cooper was in his 40s at the time of the hijacking, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that he was 40 years old flat. That means that he would be in his late 80s by now. It's possible that he's still alive. But moving on, speaking of flight attendants, let's get into the flight attendants' testimonies. Florence and Tina were both interviewed by the FBI on the same day in different cities, so there's no way that these two flight attendants could have talked to each other about what they were going to testify to the FBI. Florence was in Seattle, while Tina was in Reno. But despite this isolation, the two women both gave very, very similar descriptions of Cooper, which is a good indication that their testimony is going to be accurate. So they both said that he was about 5'10" tall. He had short black hair that was neatly combed. He had olive or, quote, swarthy skin.
Whoa.
I know, like a pirate. He had no real accent, and they both said that he was in his 40s. And Tina, even though she had spent so much time with him, couldn't definitively say what color his eyes were. But that's understandable given how terrifying the situation was, and it may have been that she was afraid to look him in the eye, so I don't blame her. Florence, however, told investigators that she was pretty confident his eyes were brown, which, even if you don't know what color somebody's eyes are, if you say they're brown, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be right.
Yeah.
Another person, other than Florence and Tina, the flight attendants who interacted with him, the third person that they interviewed the most was a passenger named Bill Mitchell. And Bill was a college student at the University of Oregon who sat across the aisle from D.B. Cooper the entire flight. And he had some interesting things to say about D.B. Cooper. Bill said that Bill was, quote, way bigger than Cooper, and Bill was 6'2". But Bill also said that Cooper was either Mexican-American or Native American, which nobody else ever said. So, you know, take that as you will.
I feel like he's probably, like, Italian. If they said he's swarthy, I feel like that's something they'd say about Italians.
I mean, you never know.
I don't know.
He also could have just been a man who spent a lot of his time working outside. He also could have been Greek. There's lots of different countries that produce an olivey skin tone, or swarthy if you're using 1970s verbiage.
Swarthy goes way back.
Yeah, swarthy is like...
Ben Franklin was calling people swarthy.
Ben Franklin was saying all sorts of stuff. After the first year and a half of their investigation, the FBI published an 8-page suspect profile on Cooper in May of 1973, shortly after the release of their third composite sketch. They said the following about Cooper. Cue the Criminal Minds theme song, because this is where Criminal Minds would come in. Close.
That's Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, that's Unsolved Mysteries.
That's this?
It's true, this is an Unsolved Mystery. So, they said the following about Cooper. They said that he is, and I'm not saying this as fact, I'm just saying that this is what the FBI said. They said he is a military-trained parachutist. He exercised regularly because multiple people said that he was fit, even though he was in his 40s. They were like, that guy in his 40s with the weird briefcase is kind of hot. Do you think he's kind of hot? I think he's hot. He works out. Then they also said that he was not a heavy drinker and he was not an alcoholic because he quickly spilled his drink after ordering it and didn't ask for another one, which I think is hilarious. He's like, can I have a bourbon and 7-Up? I spilled it. Like, instantly. So they also said that judging by the rate at which he smoked 8 cigarettes, which was about, I think it was over 5 to 6 hours, the entire hijacking, he smoked 8 cigarettes. They said he probably smokes a pack a day. They assumed that he was poor because they were like, why else would you do something this drastic and risky for money? And they also said that he was smarter than your average criminal because he had a more advanced vocabulary, aviation knowledge, he was very calm, and he also was always respectful to the female flight attendants, and he never swore or used profane language. Which basically means he was probably nicer than a lot of your average 1970s airline passengers, except for the whole, you know, bomb thing. And then, lastly, and this is the weirdest thing for me, they said that he chose the name Dan Cooper from a Belgian comic book about a Royal Canadian Air Force test pilot named Dan Cooper. In the comic book, the character Dan Cooper would do heroic things, mostly while parachuting. And these books were never sold in the U.S. They were only sold in Europe, so the FBI thought that the hijacker must have done some sort of military tour in Europe with the U.S. military, probably the Air Force.
I don't know. That seems like a stretch.
Yeah. I love how they're like, no, he had to have done it with the military. There's no reason this man could be like, I don't know, from another country or went on vacation.
Yeah. Or you could just make up the name Dan Cooper. I don't know.
Although I will say it is a weird coincidence that there is a comic book about a man named Dan Cooper who is a parachutist. And then he chooses the name Dan Cooper and parachutes out of a goddamn plane. The most compelling evidence used to identify Cooper potentially as an aviation expert was the immense amount of planning and preparation used in the hijacking. For one, despite what he told Tina, we know that Cooper did choose the 727 specifically, and we know this because of a few key things. First of all, the 727 was the only aircraft at the time that had an aft staircase that was able to be lowered in mid-flight, and it cannot be closed from the cockpit after reopening. The placement of this staircase in relation to the engines makes it possible for someone to jump off the staircase in mid-flight without being sucked into the engines and being turned into mincemeat. Also, the 727 had a unique single-point fueling system, which made it easy and fast to refuel the plane after the initial hijacking and to take off again for the weird jump flight. Number three. The 727 is one of the only commercial aircraft at the time that was able to fly low and slow consistently without stalling. With the flaps set to 15 degrees, as Cooper specified, Cooper was able to force the plane to stay within the altitude he wanted without needing to fight the pilots directly. And most interestingly, this is so, so fascinating. The CIA at the time was using the 727 during the Vietnam War to drop agents and supplies into enemy territory. That's why the 727 was designed that way, so that the CIA could allow people to jump out of the 727 mid-flight over Vietnam. So the FBI, during the investigation at this point, with this knowledge in mind, is sure that D.B. Cooper was aware of these CIA operations, and that's why he was so confident that he would be able to safely jump out of the aircraft and have a chance of making it to the ground. And also, it's the only way he could have known how that aft staircase worked at all. So he had to have had very exclusive access to information, either himself or he was really close to a direct source in the CIA.
Yeah. He was a vet.
Yeah, he could have been a vet. For all we know, he was one of the pilots that flew the 727 over Vietnam and watched people jump out himself. Who knows? True. Because we never found this guy. He could or be maybe anybody.
He was the parachutist. He was the one jumping out.
Oh, maybe he was a CIA agent. You never know.
He just loved jumping out. And he'd land and he'd say, pick me back up.
Let's do it again. Additional signs point to intense planning of the hijacking. One of these is the aforementioned seat that he chose in the plane, which was in the very back. Not only did he do this to put him in the immediate vicinity of the flight attendants so he could communicate with them without disrupting the other passengers, but it also made it impossible for someone to sneak up from behind and attack him. This also made him less noticeable to other passengers, which made it more likely that no one would be able to identify him after the hijacking was completed. Another deliberate and honestly genius move on Cooper's part was the demand for four parachutes. Again, you might think at first that demanding four parachutes was just to ensure backups in case he found the parachutes to be defective or sabotaged, but what he really wanted was ensuring that they would not intentionally provide him with faulty equipment and sabotage him and give him bad parachutes. Why would four parachutes accomplish this? Well, it's because demanding four parachutes implies that Cooper might bring another person along with him for the jump. Because of this implication, he was given four fully functional parachutes because nobody wanted to risk him jumping out of the plane with a flight attendant or a cockpit crew member and then you know, both of them dying because they were given faulty parachutes on purpose. So they had no choice but to give him fully functioning parachutes, just in case he was planning on taking someone with him on his way out of the plane, which he didn't, but it was all about the implication, as they say on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So despite the hair, cigarettes, and clip-on tie that Cooper did leave behind in the cabin, he actually went to great lengths to leave behind very little evidence. In the final minutes before he leapt from the plane, he did ask Tina to recover every single note that he wrote and give them to him so no one would track him through fingerprints, the paper, the pen, or the handwriting analysis. And when Tina, remember when she lit the cigarette, because Cooper gave her a cigarette and she's like, I've been trying to quit, but I'll smoke it, fuck it. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So Tina, when she lit that cigarette, she ended up using the last match in Cooper's matchbook. And she went to throw it away, and Cooper was like, no, 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 you're going to give me that empty matchbook because that could be used against me later. She was like, well, okay. So that was smart. So he's really trying to not leave behind evidence. And last, but certainly not least, Cooper's choice of a bomb as a weapon instead of a gun or a knife, which was much more common at the time during hijackings. People would just be like, I have a gun, I'm hijacking this plane. But he was like, no, I'm going to put together a bomb. And that was a strategic victory for Cooper because having a bomb instead of a gun or a knife made it much harder to neutralize him as a threat. Because if a hijacker just has a gun, you can kill the hijacker and the threat is over. But if a hijacker has a bomb, he may be the only person who can defuse it in time, so killing him accomplishes nothing. And additionally, a hijacker with a gun can only kill one person at a time, but a hijacker with a bomb can kill everyone at any time. And this made a situation where everybody was forced to comply with his demands. However, this whole thing is really ironic because it's possible that the bomb wasn't even real. No one ever recovered the bomb, so nobody even was able to test it, and the only thing we know is that it was real-looking enough to convince the flight attendants that it was a bomb. But I mean, like, I'm sure that Florence and Tina had never seen actual sticks of dynamite before, so how are they supposed to know whether or not it was real?
I'm just imagining, like, 4 or 5 sticks of dynamite wrapped in, like, a pocket watch.
Yeah.
And then it's like, this is a time bomb.
If somebody showed that to me, I'd be like, yep, that's a bomb. And, you know, maybe it was real. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that it's like Schrodinger's bomb. It could have been real. It also could have not been real. We have no way of knowing. But in my opinion, I think there is a decent chance that the bomb was fake because he was so calm. And like I said earlier, he almost seemed bored during the hijacking. And he went out of his way to not hurt anybody. So, I'm not even sure that it was real, to be honest. And if it was fake, then that's an even bigger pointer to him just being really, really smart. So, we've teased this a few times, but let's dig into the question we're all wondering right now, which is, did Cooper die a horrible death after he jumped out of a plane on a rainy, windy, moonless night? The answer is, just like everything else in this freaking story, it's a mystery. And I'll give evidence to support each argument, starting with the argument that he died that night. So that's the argument that we're going to cover first. The supporting ideas for his death include, but are not limited to, first, some FBI agents think that he was not an experienced skydiver, but this does contradict the FBI theory that he was a military parachutist, so I know that the FBI changed their mind at some point about that, but I think that makes their argument weaker. Number two, he may have lacked the proper equipment for a jump, and it's possible that he wasn't wearing a helmet, and he, at the time that Tina left him, was wearing unwieldy clothes like a trench coat that would flap around in the wind and make it difficult to control yourself. He would have landed in a highly forested area. The weather was very cold, wet, and windy at that altitude. At the time of the jump, a 172-mile-per-hour wind would have been blowing in his face, and the temperature was 16 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 9 degrees Celsius. He was probably wearing loafers at the time of his jump and not jump boots, and because of this, and landing at night, he probably broke his legs and or ankles. He also didn't, and that's what the FBI thinks at this point, he also didn't have the equipment to spend the night in the wilderness as far as anybody knew, and if he had an accomplice to come pick him up post-landing, the change of plans to fly to Reno instead of Mexico City couldn't have been easily communicated to this accomplice, so they wouldn't know where to pick him up. And also, like we talked about last time, and what you pointed out, Trevor, very astutely, was that the ransom money was never spent.
Mm-hmm. It's never in circulation.
Yep. So now I'm going to go through the counter-arguments that say, no, I think he lived. So here's the counter-arguments. Remember, he brought on that briefcase with the bomb, but he also brought on a paper bag. Do you remember the paper bag? We talked about it very briefly. And that's okay. We talked about it very briefly in the first episode. It was kind of like a sentence that just flew by. But he did bring on that briefcase and he brought on a paper bag. Part of the reason we didn't bring up the paper bag again is because nobody ever looked in the paper bag to see what was in it. The FBI now thinks that it's unlikely that Cooper would have thought through every little detail of the hijacking and then not thought about equipment for the jump. That just seems really unlikely. So they think that that paper bag probably had jump equipment like, you know, goggles, jump boots, and basic survival equipment. So that would make his survival a lot more likely. And also, it's possible that an accomplice was following news reports, or perhaps the accomplice had inside knowledge from the airline industry, and this would be supported if Cooper himself was in the airline industry, because maybe somebody else on the inside was working with him. Also, and this one is really interesting, after the DB Cooper hijacking, there were 3 copycat hijackers in the months that followed, and all of them jumped at similar circumstances, and they all lived. One hijacker named Martin McNally had to literally be shown how to put on the parachute before he jumped because he knew so little about parachutes. But even he lived, and he didn't know jack shit about parachutes when he jumped out of a plane. And then the second guy, his name was Frederick Hahnemann. He jumped at night into a jungle in Honduras, and not only did he live, but he sustained very, very minor injuries of just bumps and bruises. And just like D.B. Cooper, he jumped at night into a wooded area, and he turned out to be fine. And then a third hijacker named Richard LaPointe jumped out of a plane over northern Colorado in January, which I can tell you from experience because I lived there for 18 years of my life. That place is really cold in January. And he was just wearing like a shirt, pants, and cowboy boots. And even he survived his jump, again, with minimal injuries. So it is completely possible that D.B. Cooper jumped out of the plane, and despite it being at night and despite being over a wooded area, it's very possible that he lived because other people have done it in dumber circumstances. So another argument that he survived, like I said last episode, is that like simply his corpse, parachutes, and money have never been found in a long, 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 long time because it's been 52 years now. It's been 52 years since the hijacking and nobody's ever found anything except for that little boy Brian who found a few bundles of $20 bills. Lastly, there are FBI agents who do think that Cooper made it. And that's pretty good evidence. So an indication of this is a 1976 Seattle Times article where they published a quote from an anonymous FBI agent, and the quote says, "I think Cooper made it. I think that he slept in his own bed that night. It was a clear night. A lot of the country is pretty flat. He could have just walked out. Right down the road. Hell, they weren't even looking for him there at the time. They thought he was somewhere else. He could just walk down the road." And that's true. They were not looking in the right place for him at the time. He could have just left. He had several hours where nobody knew where he was and he could have just left. And also, it's the 70s. Everybody was, like, hitchhiking and shit. He could have just hitchhiked. He could have walked to a road, hitchhiked, and then, like, poof, gone, you know? Personally, like I said last episode, I do think he lived. I think if he had died, they would have found something indicating that he was dead. And the fact that the money didn't make it into circulation doesn't really mean anything either way. He could have easily hidden the money because he knew it would be tracked. And like we've said before, he was obviously a very smart man. I'll talk about my complete theory on what happened to D.B. Cooper later and who he was. But for now, let's get to the suspects. There are about 10 bajillion suspects, and talking about every single one would take like 5 years. So I'm going to discuss the two most interesting and plausible ones to me. If you have a suspect that you think is D.B. Cooper and I don't mention them, please write in and tell me your theory, because there's a lot of suspects and I just could not cover all of them. I'll feature listener theories in an upcoming episode if I get enough of them, so tell me your theory on who D.B. Cooper is. Write into maydaymaydaypod@gmail.com. Anyway. Thanks for being my cheerleader.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get to the suspects. The first suspect is a man named Ted Braden, who does look an awful lot like the sketches that the FBI made. Here's some supporting evidence that he was D.B. Cooper. He did die in like 2009. So, alas, he's not around to confirm or deny. So here's some evidence that supports the idea that he was D.B. Cooper. Ted was a Special Forces commando during the Vietnam War, and he was also an expert skydiver. He was described as someone who had a, quote, secret death wish and, quote, continually places himself in unnecessary danger but always seems to get away with it. Apparently, he frequently ignored skydiving safety protocol in the military, and his family described him as unlikable and, quote, the perfect combination of high intelligence and criminality. At the time of the hijacking, Ted was a truck driver close by in the area that the hijacking took place, and he worked for a trucking company, so, you know, perhaps a co-worker in a truck was his accomplice. That could definitely be done. He was investigated later in the 1970s for stealing $250,000 as a part of a trucking scam, which is very similar to the amount of money that was taken in the hijacking, $200,000.
A trucking scam?
Yeah, I don't know what a trucking scam even is, but he did it. And he got away with it because he was investigated, but they didn't have enough to actually charge him with anything, so he got away with it.
Dang.
I know, dang. Later, he was charged with driving a stolen car with no license in Pennsylvania. He was eventually sent to federal prison in the 80s for a crime that I could not find. He went to prison for a crime. He's done a lot of them, obviously, so.
I wonder what happened to that money. Mob ties?
Maybe.
It went into their dirty money pit.
I just pictured a hole in the ground full of money.
Yeah.
Huh. Also, his age, build, and height are all within a plausible range of D.B. Cooper. So he was in his mid-40s, he had the right age, he had the right build, and then he was a little shorter than what the flight attendant said, but his height did match up with what that college student said that called D.B. Cooper slight. Our second suspect is very interesting. The suspect is a lot less straightforward than Ted. Our second suspect is Barbara Dayton. And you might be confused because you're like, D.B. Cooper is a man. Barbara Dayton was born as Robert Dayton before they underwent a gender reassignment surgery in 1969. Barbara was one of the first people to get a gender reassignment surgery in Washington's entire history. Before her surgery, she served in the Army and the U.S. Merchant Marine during World War II, and after the war, she got her private pilot's license and became a recreational pilot and librarian at the University of Washington. She also worked professionally with explosives in construction, and she had a dream of becoming a professional airline pilot. However, she could not get a commercial pilot's license, and her dreams were squashed. This could explain why Cooper said, quote, "I don't have a grudge against your airline specifically, I just have a grudge." She claims that she carried out the hijacking using her knowledge of explosives from her construction job, and she also said that she carried out the hijacking dressed as a man, which, you know, I think that that is possible because I'm sure that gender reassignment surgery wasn't like super convincing back in 1969. So I'm sure that she could pass as a man if she wanted to. And maybe she was wearing wigs. And so maybe she was just able to take the wig off and she had short black hairs that she could use to pass as a man. And also, hijacking as a completely different gender than how you normally present yourself during the day is an excellent disguise.
Yeah.
So she said that she presented as a man that day on purpose, hijacked the plane to like get back at the FAA and the airline industry at large for denying her her career aspirations. She also claimed that the reason the ransom money was never put into circulation was because she had hidden it in a cistern around Woodburn, Oregon. But when she learned that the statute of limitations didn't apply to the D.B. Cooper case and that whenever they found who committed the hijacking, that the FBI would prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law, Barbara was like, ha ha, never mind, I didn't mean any of that. Ha ha, never mind, I'm not D.B. Cooper. And she recanted her entire statement when she found out that she could get in trouble if she was convicted. Another ding in her story is that people say that she didn't match the physical description of D.B. Cooper, but again, I feel like that's hard to tell when somebody is presenting as an entirely different gender during hijacking than they do normally. But, you know, maybe she had bright blue eyes or something, in which case that would not match D.B. Cooper, and maybe she was super pale, and that wouldn't match D.B. Cooper either. I didn't find specifics, but that's that suspect. Before we get into our own personal theories, I wanted to point out another murder that is connected to this case.
Oh my goodness.
I know. Oh my goodness. Remember Earl J. Cossey, the man who gave Cooper the parachutes and actually was a key part of the FBI investigation? Do you remember him from the first episode?
I think so, yeah.
He was the guy from the skydiving school who gave Cooper the dummy parachutes.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So on August 23rd, 2013, Earl was found murdered in his home in Woodinville, Washington.
No.
The cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head, and his killer was never caught.
Oh my goodness.
I know. Officials say burglary was probably the cause of the crime, but I don't know about that. Seems suspicious, especially because 2013 would be around the time frame where whoever D.B. Cooper is or was could have been facing his own mortality. And also, I'm sure that if he survived, he probably put two and two together that Earl gave him dummy parachutes that didn't do anything. And so maybe whoever did the hijacking, I'm just wildly speculating here, but maybe whoever did the hijacking found out, you know, maybe they were diagnosed with terminal cancer or something, and they were like, okay, time to carry out my revenge against the person, the one person who did not fully cooperate with my hijacking. And maybe he was like, I'm just gonna kill him and then take some stuff to make it look like a burglary because I'm D.B. Cooper.
Maybe.
Again, wild speculation. Do not take me seriously. I am just a lady with a podcast. I am not a law enforcement officer or a detective or anywhere close to that. So before I get to my theory on what happened, what do you think happened, Trevor? Is he alive? Who is he? Where did that money go? Go. Do it.
I think when he was parachuting down, he saw a bright light in the sky.
No, this is serious.
No, I'm serious.
No, don't make UFO... this about Marvel.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. Proceed.
He saw a bright light in the sky, and he suddenly felt weightless. As he floated up into the UFO. That's why the money has never been found. A bundle fell out. But he got abducted. Because the alien said, you're the best this planet has to offer.
I just read you 18 pages of stuff about D.B. Cooper. I'm like, what do you think? And you're like, he was clearly abducted by aliens.
I think that makes the most, that is the compromise between both sides.
You're the best this planet has to offer. Yeah. You brought dynamite on a plane and you were bored. And you spilled your 7-Up and bourbon immediately. You are the best this planet has to offer. And you have a clip-on tie from JCPenney.
No, he didn't. You're at the best. He didn't. He left it behind.
The aliens were like, okay, he took off his clip-on tie. He is now the best this planet has to offer.
I just think that's, I mean, what else could have happened to the money?
Clearly the most logical answer is an alien abduction. Oh my god. Okay, do you want to hear my much less fun theory?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So, like I said earlier, I think he lived, and I think he did this entire thing for kicks. I think he did this entire hijacking just for the thrill of it. Because I think the money was never put into circulation because I don't even think he ever intended on using it. I think the bomb was fake for reasons that I've said earlier. And he never showed any signs of violence. And he went out of his way to avoid hurting people. And there were so many men that were in their mid-40s in the U.S. at that point in time who were war veterans with brown eyes, dark hair, and olive skin. Like, that doesn't narrow down the pool at all. He could blend in anywhere. And, like, I think he did it.
Or she.
Or she. And I think he did it just to prove that he could do it. Like, I certainly don't think he died because other people survived much worse jumps and still lived. They never found his body or any of his parachutes. Like, honestly, I think that whoever D.B. Cooper really was a psychopath who was looking for a thrill. And, like, when people say psychopath, people automatically assume, like, psychopath equals violent because a lot of the time, psychopath does equal violent. But in this case, I mean psychopath in the literal sense. And the literal diagnostic for a psychopath is someone that does not experience human emotions or empathy. And I think that whoever did this was a psychopath who experienced no emotions or empathy, but didn't feel the need to be violent. But they just did this to feel something, and that would explain why he looked so bored the entire time, why he was so calm, why he didn't need to drink, and why he just smoked his cigarettes like usual. And, you know, it could very well be the first suspect that I talked about, Ted Braden, because his family members said that, you know, he had like a death wish and that he was generally unlikable, but super intelligent and prone to being a criminal. And those are the types of things that people with psychopathy get themselves into because they can't get a thrill from most things that people get a thrill from. So they have to do these extreme situations to make them feel anything. And that's why a lot of psychopaths become criminals. And in this case, I think D.B. Cooper was a nonviolent psychopath who just hijacked a plane to prove that he could do it. And then he jumped out and he lived. And then he's like, I don't want to go to jail. That's going to be really boring. So he just ditched the money. Well, not ditched it. He hid the money somewhere. Walked
in a cistern.
Maybe, yeah, in a cistern maybe. And then he walked to a road, hitchhiked somewhere random, got another pseudonym, dyed his hair maybe, I don't know, and just started over. It was the 70s. You could do anything. So, that's my theory.
That's a good theory.
Thank you. I also think he's dead by now, so I don't think we'll ever know. He could still be alive.
Yeah. Who knows? Dan Cooper.
You go, Dan Cooper. You go.
Now he's living somewhere as Can Duper.
Can Duper. That's the worst name I've ever heard. That's worse than Donut Bologna Cooper.
Can
Duper. That's all I have on DB Cooper, aka Dan Cooper, aka who the hell knows. Trevor, thanks for being with me on this 3-part adventure.
It's been great being here these past 3 weeks in the studio. Just really grinding out ideas. It's been a really big honor, and I can't think of a better series to end my time on Mayday with.
No, don't say that. I'm going to drag you back here and be like, let's talk about planes more. And you're going to be like, okay.
The contract pending negotiation.
Oh, yeah, because we have contracts. Oh, okay, so if you have any stories, theories, or suggestions, please send an email to maydaymaydaypod@gmail.com. If you like the show, please leave a review, because that makes me happy when you guys leave nice reviews. Until next time, put on your jump boots if you're getting out of a plane at 10,000 feet, get your accomplice to pick you up, and stay safe out there.